is United States v. Blunson. Ms. Kister.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. In the proceedings below, the government cited numerous reasons for refusing to file a substantial assistance motion in this case. It's not real clear which one of these really drove that determination on behalf of the U.S. Attorney's Office or whether it was a combination of them. But I would submit that none of these and even all of these reasons together do not relate to the quality of the assistance given by Mr. Blunson to justify the foregoing of this motion by the government. And I'll take a few of these, the basis or the things that they do cite as to why they're going to forego this. The predominant one appears to be that they don't like Mr. Blunson, that he's a bad guy, that he's threatened his co-defendant, and that he's made some effort while he's been in jail to procure a jailer's uniform.
Well, don't they get to choose who they work with, who they sponsor?
Well, they clearly do. The discretion is with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
And here's a guy who's trying to get out through deception, tried to threaten to kill somebody, doesn't even want to do the cooperation himself. He wants to do it through someone else, sort of a cat's paw cooperation. Can't they make that choice?
Well, I'm not sure that it's accurate that Mr. Blunson doesn't want to cooperate himself. He's constrained by being in custody, and he does appear to be making efforts by reaching out to a third party who's still on the streets, who may be more effective in setting up control buys for the government to assist him in this endeavor. But I think the proof is in the pudding. I think he goes quite a distance in cooperating, in giving information, and in cooperating. Is he necessarily a nice guy or a good guy? In looking at the testimony of the inmate at the sentencing proceeding, and clearly the district court judge had the benefit of viewing this witness, the court believed that there had been a threat against the co-defendant in this attempt to get a uniform. All I can offer on Mr. Blunson's behalf, which wasn't offered at that point, but I'll offer it now, is he might have been talking big, making threats. We don't know. He didn't actually...
It doesn't sound like the kind of person you could trust in cooperation.
But it's a slippery slope, Your Honor. I mean, we all know that the government all the time makes deals with criminals to investigate their cases, to prosecute their cases, to gain convictions. They trade time with informants and co-defendants and co-conspirators who are not nice guys, who have committed acts of criminal acts, serious acts, more serious perhaps than the one that, appears to be on the record here.
Not a nice guy is a rather absurd characterization of this person's conduct.
But it's still something, Your Honor, that's going to his character and not to the quality of his assistance.
So what? Why should that make a difference?
Well, there has to be a standard. And to the extent that this court appeared to embrace the standard of the Eighth Circuit last year in the Billings case, that the foregoing of a substantial assistance motion has to do with the assistance provided by the defendant and not his character, not that he's done something unrelated that's bad or that's criminal. To the extent that that's the standard,
Why is that a good standard?
Well, there has to be a standard, first of all, because otherwise we've got unbridled discretion on the part of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Clearly they've got discretion to pick and choose who they're going to make deals with, who they're going to believe, who they're going to present to a jury. But if it's unfettered, then they can make a deal with this guy, even though he's a bad guy, we'll make a deal with him. But we're not going to do the same in this case. With this guy, that becomes very arbitrary.
Yep. It's one of the conditions of prosecution. It's arbitrary quite frequently.
Yes, but I think it is a slippery slope, and I think
There's nothing slippery about it at all. It's just there. That's a fact. They decide who's going to be indicted, who's not going to be indicted. They decide what the deal they're going to make and with whom. And as Jimmy Durante used to say, them are the conditions that prevail. I mean, somebody's got to make the decision. They do it.
They do it. But in this case, Your Honor, Mr. Blenson also made a decision, and that was stick his neck out.
He made a decision that didn't lend itself to the prosecution as something they want to do business with. They just don't like him.
Clearly, I think that's the case.
Good enough.
I don't think that should be the basis for negating his assistance.
What you're asking us to do is to require the prosecution to describe exactly what they want to do, when they do it, and what discretion they have used in deciding not to cooperate or not to ask for a readout. And that I don't think we can do. Separation of powers prevents it. The executive gets to do that. Judiciary only gets to review what they present to us.
Well, I think this court, though, does have the right to review what the district court did.
To require that they accept the cooperation of somebody they don't want to.
The district court does.
Well,
I think this court has
held
that they can.
I don't think the district court does either, but that's neither here nor there.
I think that the district court can step in if it's based on something unconstitutional or arbitrary.
It's very artificial because the district court doesn't have to. Does the district court have to accept the motion for reduction in sentence, or is it discretionary?
No, that's discretionary in the court, too.
It's discretionary. Then the government could say, look, we're contractually obligated to ask for this reduction, you know, for substantial assistance, but we strongly recommend that you not grant it to this person because he's... You really should give him a higher sentence on the basis of the conduct he's exhibiting. What would be the point of that?
Well, the flip side of that, though, Judge, is that
the government can recommend in the strongest terms that the court give him a break, and the court can say, no, I'm not going to.
That's correct. But by the same token, the discretion has to have some boundaries. It cannot be unfettered. And
that's pretty true.
Shouldn't the sentencing judge know if this defendant being sentenced tried to escape and threatened to kill his co-defendant? And aren't those relevant things for the judge to know?
Yes. And clearly, they are under 3553A. Yes, and the court could have considered them. There would have been nothing to constrain the district court.
Even with a cooperation motion, even?
Yes, but at least he would have had the option of going beneath the mandatory minimum sentence.
But, of course, he would, right? That's completely unrealistic and totally unrealistic. It is unrealistic.
It's possible, and we're guessing, yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Kister. Mr. Cox?
By the way, proud of you. That's a good argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. There is some standard of this. There's obviously a constitutional standard.
What is the standard?
The standard the district court can review and in the appropriate case could compel if it found that the government withheld making a motion.
But the cooperation agreement, it's a contract, isn't it?
The cooperation agreement is a contract, yes.
If the government does not live up to its contract, the court can enforce it.
That's correct, Your Honor. Precisely. Of course, in this case, unlike many of the cases, there wasn't a plea agreement. There was no agreement to plead guilty and to appeal.
But the cooperation agreement itself, isn't that contractual in nature?
Yes, it is.
So don't you have to have some ground, some, you know, reasonable ground, something analogous to a contract excuse in order to be excused from your contractual duty to file the substantial assistance motion?
The cooperation agreement in this case, which was never used as a basis for the government making a motion, it was never even presented to the district court below, but it was a contract, certainly, and it was executed, and it reserved to the government the sole discretion to make the motion.
There you go.
And so... the court could review that and determine if somehow the government didn't live up to its obligations because the defendant was Muslim or black or whatever. But, of course, that wasn't even the claim in this case. The claim in this case is that the reasons that the government gave were not rational.
So you're saying it's not really a contract because it reserved it reserved an unlimited right in the government to withdraw from it. Is that
the written documents which set forth the various obligations of each party, but in that particular one, it specifically reserved to the sole discretion of the government to determine if the defense...
Is that standard in your cooperation agreements?
Yes, yes.
Whole Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, Your Honor, what would happen is that, of course, those cooperation agreements begin at the very or generally executed at the very beginning of a case when a defendant first expresses any interest in cooperating with the government, and then it's superseded or incorporated into a plea agreement that's later reached. In this case, of course, there was no plea agreement. The only agreement was the government withdrew one of the prior convictions that otherwise would have subjected Mr. Blunson to mandatory life imprisonment.
That's it.
If you have any other questions, otherwise I yield the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, Ms. Kister?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. And you were appointed, were you not? Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. Next case for argument.